Blog Talk Radio.
This episode of HR Happy Hour is sponsored by Acquire, a leading provider of workforce planning and analytics solutions so powerful they should wear tights and a cape. We enable and streamline organizational charting, succession planning, workforce modeling, and strategic workforce initiatives. Visit Acquire CEO Lois Melbourne's blog at blog.acquire.com for her enlightening insight into current HR industry issues by way of Star Trek, The Fonz, and Ebenezer Scrooge.
Welcome, everyone. It's HR Happy Hour. How's everyone doing tonight? This is Steve Bowes. With me, of course, Shauna Morkey, the HR minion. Shauna, I know you're not feeling well tonight, so I won't even ask. How are you tonight?
Oh, it's okay. I sound worse than I am. It's just
that
it's not going to be really making giggles.
All right. That sounds horrible, Shauna. I must
tell you. Oh, I don't want to sound horrible.
Get some rest, drink some tea, whatever it is you have to do to get better. So we won't call on you. We won't call on you too much tonight. Okay. So just
I'll be active on the Twitter back channel. How about that? It'll be
right,
a compromise.
Keep an eye on the back channel. Let us know if anything interesting comes up. Certainly, I'm sure there will be tonight. So great, HR Happy Hour tonight. It's episode 54. Enterprise 2.0 and HR is our topic tonight. We have an outstanding guest who will come on in a minute. Our call-in number, of course, is area code 646-378-1086. If you call in and want to come on and ask a question or make a comment during the show tonight, press 1. We'll try to take a few calls for sure tonight. If you're hanging out on Twitter, and I know you're out there, Shauna will be keeping an eye on you. Our hashtag is HR Happy Hour, of course. So that's it for announcements. Our normal, Shauna, our normal banter will have to be cut back tonight lack of a voice. And we'll get the story of your big move next week on the show. Absolutely.
Yeah, after I've actually moved.
Yeah. Right. Fantastic. So I'd like to welcome our guest to the show tonight. Really excited. Tonight to welcome Andrew McAfee, a principal research scientist at MIT. He coined the phrase, Shauna, basically invented the phrase Enterprise 2.0 a few years ago.
Cool.
That's awesome. And the author of a fantastic book, which we'll be talking about quite a bit tonight. The book is called Enterprise 2.0, New Collaborative Tools for Your Organization's Toughest Challenges. I believe it came out last year, and Andy can correct me if I'm wrong. Please welcome to the show Andy McAfee. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks for having me. Although I have to say, I feel like you're taking advantage of poor Shauna, making her come to work when she sounds so bad.
Oh,
yeah,
that's so
I know.
Nice of you.
We run a tight ship here, absolutely. We're doing the show. We're working at night, There's time and a half involved. But, Shauna would not want to turn that down, I'd imagine.
That's probably
no,
right.
No, never. I have to earn that trip to San Diego somehow.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, you'll have to work that off, that great trip you had out to Sherman. I also want to thank, of course, our show sponsor, Acquire Software, and Lois Melbourne and all the great folks at Acquire for supporting the show. So, let's get into some of our discussion tonight with Andy. Andy, Enterprise 2.0, obviously you coined the phrase, you wrote the essential book on the subject, Enterprise 2.0, that we mentioned earlier. I thought maybe since our audience is primarily made up of human resources professionals and practitioners, recruiters, those types, not everyone may be familiar with Enterprise 2.0, so I thought maybe we could start off with just describing sort of in your mind, the basic definition of Enterprise 2.0, why it's important a little bit, and perhaps even how it's different than sort of popular social media, social networking kind of activities that the folks listening to this show are familiar with.
Got it. So let me give you a loose definition of Enterprise 2.0 and then a tighter one. The loose definition is just taking the same stuff that we see with Web 2.0, and I'm talking about the technology toolkit, this grab bag of blogs and microblogs and social networking software and wikis and video sharing and all those technologies, but even more fundamentally, taking the approaches to collaboration and the philosophies about collaboration and working together that we see in the Web 2.0 world and bringing them inside the enterprise. Now, I still find that really loose, so let me give you a tighter definition.
Okay.
For me, Enterprise 2.0 is about organizations using emergent social software platforms for their own business purposes. So social software, you probably don't have to define too much. For me, the two important parts of that definition are, first of all, the word emergent, which means that even though we don't bake in a lot of structure, a lot of workflow, a lot of hierarchy, a lot of stuff up front, we still wind up with environments that have a lot of structure. They're easy to search and navigate and find stuff on. People assign themselves into roles. There's all the stuff we expect to see from a well-functioning digital community, even though we didn't bake that stuff in up front. And then the last part of the definition is the for their own purposes part of it, which means
right.
that we're not just doing it to advance some social agenda. We're not just doing it to try to sell stuff to teenagers on the web. We're not just doing it to help people waste time at work. We're doing it to make better widgets and sell more widgets to our customers with higher levels of productivity.
Yeah. Andy, that's very interesting. You touched on several of the points that certainly are run throughout the book that I do want to talk about during the course of the show tonight. In particular, one of them you mentioned about sort of emergence and patterns being forming. And in the book, you talk a little bit, you make an analogy to ant colonies.
Yeah.
Right? That any individual ant, if you watched it really closely, it'd be hard to sort of tell what was going on in the overall colony. But sort of combined all these ants doing their different tasks and running around, then you can sort of, from a macro view, see the patterns emerging.
Well, and ant colonies are such a great example because they're so deeply weird, because colonies clearly do things as a unified whole. They search for food, they build, and they build bigger and bigger colonies over time. They tend their young. They can actually wage war using very sophisticated strategies. They have life cycles. They're born, they grow, they die over time. So you'd watch this, and your first reaction would be somebody has to be in charge of this thing. The queen of the colony has to be directing the troops somehow. But when you look more closely, you realize no such thing is going on. There's no central direction to an ant colony. There's no real management structure that you can talk about. And each individual ant couldn't tell you what the colony is doing, doesn't know what the colony is doing. And if you watched one ant, you couldn't, just from looking at that one ant, infer what the whole thing is up to. But again, when you step back and take a look at the entire superorganism, you see it acting with great purpose and with something that looks like an explicit goal in mind. And the web is a very close parallel to an ant colony. It's definitely got a structure. It seems to be heading places at time. It's got these trends and directions, but no one can tell you no individual can dictate what the web is up to. And if you watch any one site or any one contributor, you're not going to learn anything about the web as a whole. You have to go up and look at the whole thing. So
yeah.
I think of both these as classic emergent systems.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy, and it also helps to sort of explain a little bit, because you're really talking about a technological phenomenon to some extent by not really talking about technology at all, but talking about patterns of behavior and activity in an organization.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, we geeks love to dive into the details of any particular technology and obsess about them. The rest of the world really doesn't care that much. They just want to get work done. They would just like their organizations to run better or their jobs to be more satisfactory to them. One of the cool things about the 2.0 movement is that, for once, it feels like the geeks are in harmony with the users and with the managers. We're all basically trying to do the same thing.
Right, I love that. I love that. Shauna, that's our line for tonight, the geeks being in harmony with the business. That's fantastic. So,
well, you know,
again,
let me do a
quick reset. This is HR Happy Hour. Our guest is Andy McAfee, author of Enterprise 2.0, creator of the coiner of the phrase Enterprise 2.0 a few years ago. Our call-in number tonight, 646-378-1086. Please call in if you want to get on board tonight. We do have a number of folks on board. We will take a few calls shortly. Perhaps I forgot to mention we do like to take calls, so I hope that's okay with you if we take a few.
No, I forbid that.
Yeah. That's not allowed. All right. Yeah, it depends on who's calling, right? We'll do a good job of monitoring that. So, and on Twitter, again, HR Happy Hour, Shauna, our no-voice Shauna tonight is going to keep an eye out on the Twitter stream for the show tonight. So another point I wanted to make, Andy, you touched upon the emerging social software platforms that really sort of make up the technological framework or the foundation of Enterprise 2.0 projects. But before we look at what's going on in the enterprise, in the book you spend a little bit of time sort of documenting or describing your path to sort of discovering this and sort of creating the Enterprise 2.0 term. And you talked about Wikipedia in particular, and also a little bit about, or in terms of organization, about Yahoo and the evolution of Yahoo. So I thought perhaps you might want to touch a little bit, perhaps at least on the Wikipedia story and how that sort of informed your thinking about Enterprise 2.0.
So when I first started hearing the phrase Web 2.0, which came out in, I started hearing it probably late 2004, early 2005, I really just reacted with profound skepticism. I thought this was the worst kind of self-serving hype from the high-tech sector, from the technology vendors. I thought they were trying to put old wine in new bottles. And when you think about it, they were making an extraordinary claim that a whole new version number of the web is warranted. And I thought, come on, give me a break. And especially after the tech wreck and the Y2K fiasco passed, I really thought that tech was getting boring for a while and that this whole Web 2.0 meme was an idea to make something interesting that was actually kind of calm. And the only credit I'll give myself is that I at least had the integrity to go test this hypothesis that I had, that there was nothing interesting going on. But I wanted to test it just as quickly as possible and to go to one thing out there that exemplified Web 2.0 where I could watch it not work very well and then walk away. So I'd been hearing about this mass-produced, collaborative, editor-free, totally volunteer, no workflow encyclopedia called Wikipedia, and I thought, aha, this will be Exhibit A for the failures of Web 2.0, because it sounds cool, and maybe it's got this wiki technology underlying it, which is kind of novel, but this thing is not going to work. It's just literally not going to work, especially after it hits some level of scale, because what happened previously with these utopian ideals on the net was that a bunch of people of goodwill would get together, they'd start building something, they'd open it up to the whole world, and then, I mean this literally, the Nazis would show up. And then some people who love to destroy value would show up, and they'd start flaming, and they'd start the hate speech and the trolling behavior, and the people of goodwill would find it not worth their time or effort to keep fighting these jerks, and they'd eventually walk away, and the community would wither. And then we saw that happen a bunch of times in Web 1.0. So when I heard about Web 2.0 and Wikipedia, I thought, fantastic, I'm just going to go watch this breakdown happen. And I actually thought for a while when I first fired up Wikipedia, what one entry can I go to where I will watch the flame war break out and I'll understand how Web 2.0 is all just going to fizzle out. And so the very first word that I typed into a search box in Wikipedia was skinhead. And I went to the skinhead page expecting to see the two different types of skinheads, the racial hatred skinheads versus the racial harmony skinheads screaming at each other back and forth in this digital environment as opposed to doing anything valuable. And what I saw instead was the single best general reference article about skinheads that I'd ever come across. And I remember I sat there and I read it for, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour, and I looked up thinking, first of all, man, that was really interesting. I know a lot more about skinheads. And then I said, wait a minute. I've actually just spent a half hour reading an article about skinheads instead of an intra-skinhead flame war. Something is different here. So some combination of new technologies and new flavors of community or energy that's accentuating the good and mitigating against the bad. And this is fascinating. I have to go understand this more.
Yeah, right. And that's it was really interesting the way you described that in the book. And then sort of what carried on from that in the book, certainly, and follows up with the emergent social software platform idea is what the points you made about Yahoo and what Yahoo sort of started out as and sort of what they became and what by extension the internet itself became.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think hopefully a lot of us participating in this show are old enough to remember the 1.0 era. And I remember when the internet...
Shauna is not, I don't think.
Shauna is not.
Okay.
Shauna, here's a bit of internet history for you. There used to be this thing called the Yahoo categorization system. And back in the early days of Web 1.0, the search technology actually didn't work all that well, wasn't nearly as powerful as we have now. So, and none of us knew where all the good stuff was on the web. So Yahoo got started. The word initially was an abbreviation. It stood for yet another hierarchically organized oracle or something very close to that. And they were a librarian for the web. And the Yahoo homepage was a Dewey Decimal system for the internet. They categorized it into entertainment, computers and internet, business, sports, all these different things. And you would navigate around the web, a lot of us, by drilling down through that categorization system. And then what happened is the web just kept growing exponentially. It became harder and harder for Yahoo to keep up with that. And as a result, they spent comparatively less and less time on it. And that taxonomy, that categorization system of the web started to shrink on their homepage. And I grabbed these screenshots in the book that shows how that categorization system gets smaller and smaller on the Yahoo homepage and eventually just fades away because the company just got overwhelmed by the size and complexity of the web. So this kind of librarian approach to the web stopped working very well. And the Google approach to the web, which is we're going to let the web itself tell us what the web is about and where the good stuff is, and we're going to navigate around by search instead of drilling down, that started to gain currency instead.
Right, right. And the importance of the Google approach was not just that. We decided, okay, we're not going to try to categorize everything anymore, but we're going to develop an algorithm called PageRank that's going to value how the free and diverse and individual users of the internet have decided to link pages and relate pages to each other and sort of value pages themselves and have that be the primary mechanism to surface pages, you know, to the top of search results.
And the two Google founders were either done with or in the middle of computer science advanced degrees. One of the things you do as a doctoral student in the sciences is read a ton of papers. And what makes a paper good is the number of other papers that refer to it. It's just the coin of the realm in
right.
academic publishing. So these guys were deeply immersed in that world. Their massive insight was to realize that the web works exactly the same way. And a link from one page to another is a citation to that page. And they said, wait a minute, the web has this fantastic citation index. It's big. It's very, very fine-grained. It's growing all the time. And it's got this really cool geodesic dome kind of property where the bigger it gets, the more powerful it gets. So they said, man, all we have to do is harvest that. I'm making something very complicated sound trivial, but all we have to do is harvest that, and we will know what the web is about, and the web will keep defining itself for us, and we can find what we're looking for and separate the wheat from the chaff as searchers, no matter how any of us define what the wheat is versus the chaff.
Right, right, and sort of no one individual's determination or contribution to that organization really was any better or worse than anyone else's, right? There was no editor, no sort of controller of the hierarchy anymore.
Not at all, and it was a comparatively hard system to game. Your vote counted for more if you had more, if your page links counted for more, if you yourself had more pages linking to you. But Google's become pretty good at finding people who are trying to game that system and then making sure that they have less influence inside their entire algorithm.
Right, right. So let's do a quick reset before we sort of move from the consumer slash, you know, individual web to what's going on inside enterprises. We are on HR Happy Hour Thursday night. Of course, where else would you be, Shauna?
Right.
Where else?
There's no place else to be.
So,
yeah, Lance needs to stop going to barbecues and make sure that he listens more.
Yeah. Come on. You need to plan your schedule around this. So
seriously, Lance.
Come on. Ridiculous. So HR Happy Hour, we're talking about Enterprise 2.0 and HR. Our guest, of course, Andy McAfee, author of Enterprise 2.0, New Collaborative Tools for Your Organization's Toughest Challenges. Shauna's with us with very little voice. Our call-in number, once again, 646-378-1086. Press 1. There are lots of people hanging out on the line tonight. So if you want to come on and ask a question or make a comment, just go ahead and press 1, and I promise we will get to a few calls in a moment. So getting back to what we were talking about, Andy, so you're looking at Wikipedia, you're seeing the evolution of what's happening on the Internet and Yahoo. So when does the shift happen, at least in your research and in your thinking or what's happening inside organizations? When do organizations start to embrace or at least experiment with some of these Web 2.0 concepts inside the organization?
It's been a really interesting progression to watch how old-fashioned 1.0 organizations become aware of Enterprise 2.0 and get interested in it. And honestly, back in the early days, I noticed most often it was when execs that I would talk to would say, hey, I see my kids messing around on Facebook all the time, and I see them doing their homework using Wikipedia. I think there's something going on there. Can you explain to me what this is and why we might be interested in it as a business? So that's what started happening. More recently, the same kids who were on Facebook and doing their homework on Wikipedia are now starting to enter the workforce. So the millennials are becoming a fairly big deal in helping increase awareness and interest about the 2.0 tools and the approaches to getting work done that are built on top of them. But that's kind of the supply side. On the demand side, the most brilliant quote I ever heard to summarize why this stuff is valuable for enterprises came from Lou Platt, who was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, and he said, if only HP knew what HP knows, we'd be 3 times as productive. It's just this brilliant summary of the problem that we all know that we're spinning our wheels, we're reinventing things, we're thrashing around in our knowledge work, and somewhere out there in the enterprise or somewhere out there in the network, there's someone who could absolutely nail it for us, just really help us out, put hours back in our week, or just make us so much smarter, but we don't know who that person is, or we can't find them, or we can't locate them right now. And the part of the beauty of the 2.0 movement is addressing that problem and helping the organization know what it knows.
You know, in prior to 2.0, right, organizations knew that too, right? It didn't just happen in 2006 where,
yep,
you know, organizational leaders decided, boy, there's a lot of knowledge out there and we just can't find it, or people are not finding the right resources to do their jobs quickly, efficiently, and to innovate. And so there was a whole class of software, there still is a whole class of software that you talk about some in the book that ostensibly was meant to address some of these challenges and help organizations meet them, like knowledge management systems and groupware. They've been around for a long time now, and so maybe you could comment a little bit about why those particular types of technology didn't really solve the problems that they were, at least in theory, meant to solve.
And Steve, you make a good point. Organizations have been aware of this problem for a long time, and they have been trying to apply technology and deploy technologies to help with this problem. Because after some scale, you can't solve this problem with face-to-face anymore. You can't bring everyone into one conference room. You can't have knowledge-sharing sessions as your organization gets big and goes around the world. So we have to throw technology at this problem as we scale. You mentioned knowledge management systems. And to my eyes, the central failure of these things is that they weren't emergent. In other words, the gurus responsible for a KM deployment would decide what the knowledge of the organization looked like. And they'd build a database to hold the knowledge of that organization. They'd define the structure of that database in advance. They'd throw it out there in the organization. And they'd say, hey, everyone, in your ample spare time, why don't you contribute the contents of your brain to this database that we've set up? Now, I'm being a little bit unfair, but only a little bit, actually. There are two problems there. The first one's an incentive problem. Why are all these busy knowledge workers going to contribute the contents of their brain to a KM system? The even deeper problem, though, is that we've defined what we're looking for in advance, and we have no flexibility to modify that over time or to react to events as they unfold. And when you listen to Ward Cunningham, who was the inventor of wiki technology, talk about why he did it, he said, look, I was so frustrated with project management software because we would define all the things that we thought were going to be important about the project. Every time, what turned out to be important was what we didn't anticipate. It was something else that came up. And all the technologies we would use to manage the project or manage knowledge or whatever fell down in the face of that particular problem. One of the great things about emergent systems is that they are fluid and dynamic and reactive, and they're great at changing themselves in response to conditions on the ground.
Right. Yeah. So true. I mean, we've all, right, everybody listening to this show, right, has worked with either knowledge management systems or a Lotus Notes type of system in the past, right? And they've been around forever, right? But they never really seem to get beyond, oh, just sending one-off emails to each other or really stale, static information that could only be updated by one or, you know, a few select people, right?
Exactly. And Lotus Notes was a really powerful technology. It was great for a few purposes. It was a great email system. It was a great group calendaring system. And there was a scholar who looked around at how these groupware deployments were actually being used. He found the most common use case and the one that actually got some traction was to enforce a business process, was to define it and then roll it out, you know, for doing things like getting your expenses submitted or recording your time or something. So groupware was originally intended to support this spontaneous, free-flowing work. When we actually looked at how it was being used exactly like ERP systems, basically, to define and then deploy a fairly rigid, fairly standardized business process.
Right. And so moving on from that, so moving on from the more or less, I wouldn't say failed because that's not a fair expression, but the less than completely successful experiments with groupware and knowledge management systems. Andy, just quickly comment a little bit, if you could. What changed in your mind about the tools available to enterprises that have made the new set of tools that are emerging in the last few years and continue to evolve? What two or three or four things have made them so much better at helping organizations and collaboration and expertise location than what we had in the past?
The smart technologists of the 2.0 era have done three really fundamental things that are a sharp break with the past. And they're such a sharp break with the past that I think the 2.0 suffix is actually warranted. The first thing they did was move away from channels for collaboration, channel technologies like email, where it's a point-to-point private communication, and they moved to what I would call platforms, where the content sticks around, where you contribute content to a universally visible digital platform, and everyone who's got authority to use that platform sees the stuff. So from private to public information. The other thing that they did was when they opened up these platforms, they opened them up to all comers. In other words, they stopped trying to play gatekeeper about who can contribute and who couldn't. Another really fundamental thing they did was basically throw out the rules or throw out the hard and fast policies about what good contribution looks like, what's the workflow here, what's the hierarchy, what are the differential roles and responsibilities, and they just kind of welcomed all comers, and they said, hey, do whatever you want. Now, that sounds like kind of a hippie philosophy, and maybe we like hippie philosophies, and maybe we don't, but it also sounds like a recipe for chaos. In other words, you know, you invite a bunch of hippies to your field, maybe you get Woodstock, but your field looks like hell afterward. It's just a recipe. It's
right.
A recipe for chaos and for losing track of stuff and for getting the needles lost in the haystack. So the last thing the technologists of the 2.0 era have done, which is so fantastic, is that they have built in these mechanisms or these tools that let structure emerge even when we invite all comers in and even when we throw out the rule book about who can do what and what constitutes appropriate or inappropriate behavior. So we've got these mechanisms like we just talked about with Google search. We've got linking. We've got tagging. We've got voting. We've got reputation mechanisms. We've got karma and things like Slashdot. We've got the Facebook like button. We've got all these really, really clever, very lightweight ways to summon structure over time, even though we don't dictate a lot of structure up front.
Right. And I do want to make one quick comment, and then we're going to take a phone call. Our friend Mark Bennett out there, hi, Mark, listening, made a very interesting tweet that I want to come back to, and he mentions that he thinks capturing know-how is not as effective as having those who have the know-how collaborate with others. And it's a good point Mark is making, and I want to circle back to that, Andy, because you talked quite a bit in the book about the intelligence agencies' work with E2O and the Intellipedia and whatnot. And certainly some of the commentary in there supports that it wasn't just about information being findable, but it was about connecting the right people to each other as well. So I do want to come back to that idea, Mark, and thanks for making that observation. Let's go ahead and take a phone call, Shauna. What do you say? Line 10?
Great idea.
Line 10, area code 808. You're on the HR Happy Hour.
Hi, this is Beth.
Hi, Beth.
Hi, Beth.
How are you?
Hi, guys. This is Beth at Knobscot. How are you?
Oh, great. Thanks for calling.
Sure. I was just calling. This is a fantastic conversation. I've been following Andy's work for a long time, and, of course, being involved in the Enterprise 2.0, if we can use the term broadly, movement in terms of the technology. And I thought I would maybe, if you would like to give me a couple of seconds to share some of the lessons learned that we've had with organizations that are actually implementing Enterprise 2.0.
Yeah, Beth, go right ahead.
Please, we always love to hear reports from the field.
Yeah, I think a lot of what you say is really spot on in terms of how it works and what makes it work and what makes it not work. Two main points that we've seen that can really make the program not take off, and oftentimes these things do not take off. And the first one is that you really need the quantity of numbers in your program. And one of the biggest mistakes that companies are making, and I'm not quite sure the answer to it, but is pilot programs. And, of course, in HR, that's how we tend to roll out programs. We try it out on a small scale, and then we want to see how it's going to grow and take our lessons learned and move it from there. The challenge that we've seen with companies that implement the small pilot programs is the quantity of folks involved. There's some statistics, Andy probably knows the numbers off the top of his head, but of what percentage of people actually contribute initially to a program, there's a whatever it is, 5% or 10% will actually post, and then maybe 10 or 20% will actually comment on those posts. And then the rest are the lurkers.
Yep.
And so if your population is too small, it can be difficult to get that off the ground. New people will come in, they'll look, they won't see content, and it dies on the vine.
Beth, can I jump in for a second? Because I just want to underscore what an important point you make. I wrote a post a while back, a couple actually, about this idea of small-scale pilots and how they seem like such a good idea because they minimize risk and you can learn and go on from there. But I think there are two real problems with them when it comes to Enterprise 2.0. One is the numbers problem that Beth just identified, and you if a relatively small percentage of people are going to take the plunge and contribute, especially in the early phases, that kind of implies you need to open it up to a lot of people. So there's probably a minimum efficient scale for an initial project that's bigger than we see a lot of times with pilots. The second issue, though, is that where I think the real value, the real juice of Enterprise 2.0 comes in, is connecting people who would not know about each other otherwise. It's converting potential ties into actual ties or helping people interact with distant colleagues or weak ties. Too often when I see companies launch their Enterprise 2.0 pilots, they do it with a group of 50 people who already know each other pretty well. And I think that for all the benefits you might get with that, you're actually missing out on the most profound stuff, which is to help those 50 people know about all the potential other good colleagues out there inside the enterprise.
Completely agree with that. In fact, some of the technology actually can work counter to what you're trying to do if it's the kind of technology where it's you're only connected to your friends. And so
You
want to make sure it's not where you only get to communicate with the people who are already your friends. But as Andy says, that doesn't bring the power to it.
Yeah, and Beth, that's a great point. You're leading me right into the next little subject I wanted to bring up with Andy, which was the whole idea of tie strength. And how understanding tie strength and the types of people you're trying to connect and the work problems you're trying to solve, how tie strength and the problems you're trying to solve influence your decisions about technology decisions and deployment options. And so that takes us right to that next conversation that I was hoping we could have. So Andy, we hear lots of times in Enterprise 2.0 and other types of projects that, oh, it's not technology, it's about people, it's about behavior, it's about changing, you know, the ways people do work, and I think a lot of that is true, but you make a really important point, I think, in the book and spend quite a bit of time on discussing the concept of tie strength and why it's important in evaluating Enterprise 2.0 and technologies. So I thought maybe you could share a little bit of what you've learned about tie strength and how that influences the choices of technology inside the enterprise.
Yeah, and Steve, as you say, it's actually a pretty fundamental concept to my book, and it actually grew out of a frustration that I was having. When I saw Facebook and got my first account and started messing around with it, I pretty quickly decided that it was a really valuable tool for enterprises, but I wasn't quite sure on why. I just had this kind of gut-level reaction that this is really valuable for businesses. And I went out there and I actually tried to talk to a couple of businesses with that kind of vague idea, and I kept trying to articulate it, and I would fail miserably. And I just remember I'd have these skeptical executives saying, okay, can you explain Facebook and its value to me? And I'd try. And I could just see that I wasn't getting through at all. So I was getting really frustrated. And I remembered a paper that I read when I was a doctoral student in business school, which is one of the landmark papers in organizational sociology called The Strength of Weak Ties. And it's one of those great papers where the conclusion is right there in the title. And the author, whose name was Mark Granovetter, made the point that we very often focus on our close professional colleagues, our strong ties. And we do a lot of work to make those strong ties even stronger. You know, we design office layouts so you walk by the right people. We do offsites. We do team building. We strengthen our already strong ties. His point in the paper, though, was that if you want novelty and you want innovation and you want bridges to other social networks, your weak ties, the people you don't know as well, the ones you're not in contact with as often, maybe the ones you worked with a while back who have then moved on, all these different flavors of weak tie are actually more valuable. They're the right places to go for novelty and innovation and bridges to other networks. Your strong ties are inferior in those regards. It was a pretty radical theory when it came out. As you can imagine, there's been a bunch of research done to test it, and the theory holds up like a champ. It's just a great insight about how the world actually works. So the instant I cast my mind back to that paper, I said, Eureka, this is the right way to talk about Facebook. Facebook is a vehicle for you to build and maintain and hopefully exploit a network of weak ties. And historically, we have had lousy technologies for helping us keep on top of what our network of weak ties is up to and inform them about what we're up to. We've just had terrible tools for that. The best answer I ever got when I asked the question of how did we do this in the old world was the Christmas letter. you know, where your weird uncle sends you a letter every December where he gives you a year's worth of updates about the family and everything that's happened, and you kind of read that and go, that was weird, and you throw it away. Well, what's happening there is a weak tie is trying to keep you up to date with what they're doing. In the era of Facebook, that problem has become trivially easy. The problem is just solved. And with Facebook and LinkedIn and these other social tools, we have fantastic ways to maintain very tight oversight of our weak tie networks, even big ones, and use them and help them along and continue to interact with them. And if we believe that weak ties are strong, then we have to conclude that these tools are really powerful.
Right. And I think there's different sort of approaches you might make inside the organization to problems that need to be solved by a closely tied work group versus problems that might need to be solved by, you know, informing people or exposing ideas across a wider, less strongly tied organization, or even, as you mentioned in the book a little bit, folks you never know, you might never meet ever in person, and you may never come across again, but they might have something interesting to contribute, whether it's in terms of a prediction market or just contributing an answer to a general Q&A forum that an organization might set up.
And I think one of the great benefits of microblogging, of these tools like Twitter, where you sign up to follow people and you subscribe to their tweet stream, is that it lets you build a network that even goes beyond what you build with your social networking software. The people who follow me on Twitter are some combination of my strong ties, my weak ties, and then non-existent ties. I don't know who they are. I have no like real world connection to them, but they're out there following the things that I'm contributing. And once in a while, they reach out to me. Twitter is a pretty good tool for this as well. And they say something, they help me out, they show me a link, they answer a question that I have. And it's become a way for me to actually augment my network just by getting my little 140 character tweets out there and reacting to what other people are doing.
Right.
So the ties are getting blurrier, which I think is great, as a great development.
Yeah, I just wanted to share how the weak ties is playing out in the Enterprise 2.0 of what we've seen. One of the real keys has been the weak ties has created more innovation. Strong ties can tend to, nobody wants to rock the boat with their buddies.
Yep.
And using an Enterprise 2.0 type platform where you're pulling together these people who are coming from different viewpoints and getting these cross-functional departments together in different ways, you're able to have someone say, no, that's a stupid idea, but what about this? And being able to have someone push the envelope a little bit more than they might with a fully strong tie environment.
Right. Yeah, Beth, I think that's a very, very good point. I want to do a quick reset. Beth, hang out with us. Thank you so much for calling. Please stay on with us as long as you can. Beth, Andy, I have to tell you, Beth is, I think, right, normally and hopefully right now, out in the paradise of Hawaii, so it's still sunlight.
Oh,
and
nice.
Beautiful.
Aloha.
So we're probably keeping her away from something wonderful right now.
Just
but,
from work. It's okay.
Okay. Grouch,
oh, yeah,
Matt.
Just from work.
Yeah, no, and you're the boss, so you're allowed to make that determination, so fantastic. So we're on HR Happy Hour with Andy McAfee. Beth Carvin graciously has joined us as well. Thank you so much, Beth. We're talking about Enterprise 2.0 and HR. Our call-in number is 646-378-1086. Press 1 if you want to ask a question or make a comment. We absolutely can take a couple more calls if you'd like to get on board. On Twitter, our hashtag is HR Happy Hour. Shauna, our no-voiced co-host, is monitoring Twitter. Is there anything, Shauna, we should ask Andy about or just make any observations you see out there that are important?
People were really getting into the whole weak tie conversation.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I've read the Granovetter piece as well. You know, the funny thing, Andy, is that piece was written almost 40 years ago,
yep.
Right? And it still informs a lot of the thinking about these really modern, ultra-hip, ultra-new technologies and how they really work. Which I think is really, really interesting.
It's really one of those timeless insights, but it was waiting around for a set of technologies to really let us be able to put it into practice in a profound way, and now we're there.
Yeah, so we're there, right? So let's take it. We have about 15 or so more minutes to talk on the show, and there's never enough time. But so we're there, right? We're buying in, especially the folks listening to this show, right? If you're listening to a Blog Talk Radio show, at least in the East, at 8:45 on a Thursday night, you're sort of bought into Web 2.0 and probably Enterprise 2.0 where you work. So we've bought in. So what's the next step? So if I'm a person who's interested in this and I want to bring these types of technologies or tools to my organization, let's say up until this point really hasn't experimented or researched them, Andy, what are some of the things I might do, particularly from the perspective of an HR professional who are probably most of the audience tonight?
You might want to find a good book that all of your senior colleagues could read to make brutally clear what's going on here.
Enterprise 2.0, perhaps?
That was just a completely shameless plug. The first job is to, I believe, educate the managerial ranks of the organization. In other words, as we've looked, the resistance does not come from the IT department. The geeks of the organization get this. The rank and file increasingly is receptive to this, especially as the millennials enter the workforce. So the education, the initial education and coaching job about why we should do this and how the risks are actually not as bad as we think, that job happens in the managerial ranks of the organization. Once you can get them comfortable and you actually deploy a toolkit, then I believe the job shifts to educating the frontline employees, the rank and file, about what this thing is, what we want you to do, leading by example and coaching, and starting to model the behaviors that we want to see out there.
And when you talk about modeling behaviors, specifically, and then certainly more general, it's something I was interested in as we prepared tonight's show, and some of the tweeters out there, Mark and Mark, both have asked as well, is some of your observations or thoughts about how Enterprise 2.0 fits or how the HR function, the HR leader in particular, A, should be involved in this, and B, how it affects sort of the HR function in an organization that maybe has wildly deployed or at least somewhat deployed Enterprise 2.0 tools. How do you see the impact to the HR leader?
I think this is primarily great news for the HR leader in the organization. Some of my colleagues and I go back and forth about what's the cake versus what's the icing here. And the two candidates are the fact that people like their jobs better because they honestly feel like they have more of a voice in the organization. They have the ability to be a good, helpful colleague more widely. They have the ability to form ties throughout the enterprise and maintain those ties. All these things make us feel good. So there's the fact that this is I hate this overused word, but these are an empowering set of technologies for the individuals in the organization. The other candidate for icing versus cake is the fact that it helps the most pragmatic executive achieve her business objectives. It does let you get more widgets out the door every day. For me, the cake, the real benefit is the hard business benefits. The icing on the cake is that people tend to like their jobs better, but maybe from an HR professional's point of view, those two get flipped around, and we need to concentrate on the fact that these tend to be satisfaction-increasing tools and philosophies.
Yeah, and Andy, you know, you mentioned this a little bit in the book, sort of in passing, that some organizations you walk into or some scenarios you're in, you find that the HR functions a little bit apprehensive, a little worried, perhaps worried about policies and control and whatnot. And in other cases, you find HR professionals kind of receptive and open. The book was written about a year or so ago, maybe a little bit more. Do you sense any of that has shifted now in sort of the middle of 2010 towards sort of that policy enforcement and control mindset that many in HR tend to have?
I see a shift toward embracing the 2.0 movement by HR professionals. They're so concerned with the war for talent. They're so concerned with getting the best people in the organization and keeping them around. A lot of them are also very concerned with the fact that a lot of the senior people in the organization are going to leave before too long. There's this demographic bulge that's going to leave the workforce in the coming years. And when all that knowledge and expertise leaves the organization, that could be a pretty tough occurrence. One of the things that we're optimistic about is that these tools will help record some of what the senior folk in the organization know even more optimistically, it might help them maintain ties back to the organization even after they've taken their retirement.
Right.
So for a lot of different reasons, I've noticed a pronounced shift just in fairly recent times where the HR function seems to be more and more excited about this.
Yeah. We have one more question I want to get to, and then we'll get close to our wrap-up. We have another caller who wants to get on board on the HR Happy Hour with Andy McAfee talking about Enterprise 2.0 and HR. So let's go to line number 8 and area code 65. Let me try one more time. There you go, 650. You're on the HR Happy Hour.
Steve?
Yes, hey, is this Mark?
Yeah, okay.
Hey,
yeah,
Mark.
I was typing another tweet, sorry.
Hurry up.
Oh, Mark. Come on.
I wanted to talk about the problem that sometimes we're a bit of an echo chamber here, right? Because we're all social media nuts. And so we tend to go out there and say, well, why can't people be more like us? And the fact is that not everybody's like us, but social media can still do stuff for them. And what we have to do is help them see what it can do for them and say, you don't have to be like us, but you can still get something from this. And I just think that it'll be good for us not to get too impatient with people and let them find what value they can in it in their own unique ways.
Mark, I think that's a great point, right? Because some people will be more than happy to actively participate and create content and share it, while others might be more comfortable with just commenting, and still others might just want to hit a little button that says, I like this, or this was a good answer, right? But all those contributions are valuable.
Right. Yeah, I get a little worried when I saw, like, about a year back, there was a little bit of a meme going on about saying, well, why don't we measure people's participation in social networks as a way to encourage them to participate more? And I was like, yeah, that's going to work. So.
But, and I was actually, and it's interesting, I was actually one of the people advocating that measurement. But I hear what you're saying. And what I was advocating was a very multidimensional approach to measurement where we take into account the fact that not everybody is a natural blogger. Not everybody is going to want to tweet. There are many different ways to be helpful here. I just think that the goal of helping the organization know what it knows is such an important goal, and there's no way we're going to do this unless people start contributing to these environments that you get what you measure, and some flavor of non-big brother, non-scary measurement would be valuable. But
I agree 100%.
Okay.
I think that for the organization to understand itself better is a good thing. As always, I tend to mistrust management in their application of those tools, and that's the part that concerns me, is are they going to help the individual who, to me, the better scenario is the person comes to the manager and says, you know what, I don't feel like my voice is being heard enough, and have the manager say, well, have you tried maybe doing a blog, or have you tried maybe becoming more involved in your social network, and let the person say, yeah, maybe I'll try that because it'll give me kind of what I'm looking for, which is a greater voice.
I hear you, and I think you make a really lovely point, which is that maybe the manager should be trying to help their employees and elicit this kind of stuff instead of saying, okay, now on your next job review, we're going to spend 20 minutes looking at your social media participation. There are many ways to screw this up by over-measuring it. I just was trying to make the point that if you measure it correctly, it could be a great benefit.
There are also some interesting measurements that you can do from an HR perspective, such as looking at the folks that participate and then comparing their employee retention against folks that don't participate, or promotions, and being able to use this to sell the case to senior management. Because we're seeing it's not the HR people that are putting the block on wanting to do these programs. It's coming from their management. They're pushing it, and senior management is saying, not sure if we're ready for that. So we're trying to build the case for how it's beneficial.
Yeah, that's a great point, Beth. And also sort of again, Beth, once again, you take me into my sort of next point I wanted to make, or the next set of questions I wanted to ask. So,
Beth.
Great job. Thank you, Beth. Mark, thank you so much. Hang out with us if you'd like to for the remainder of the show.
Clarify that's Mark Bennett.
Mark Bennett. I know. I'm sorry, Mark Bennett. I knew it was Mark Bennett.
I know, but people thought it was Stelzner.
Okay. That's fine. Andy, the last thing I wanted to ask a little bit, like, so an organization has sort of done an evaluation, has examined what sort of the outcomes it is they're trying to affect or influence or problems they're trying to solve, and they've decided to deploy some type of technology, internal blogging, wiki, microblogging, whatever the case may be. You talk in the book about there are two main barriers that can sort of come up and inhibit success in Enterprise 2.0 projects. One is that people will use them. People, you know, executives worry about that. And the other is people won't use them. So I thought maybe you could just briefly talk a little bit about those two sets of barriers or problems that come up in E2O projects and what you've seen in your research and your consulting that sort of helps you explain away these types of issues in organizations that may be worried about them.
And this goes back to the point that I was making earlier about how initially we need to work on allaying the fears of management, and then we need to work on encouraging participation from the rank and file. And management tends to be, before they become comfortable, they tend to be really concerned about all the possible bad things that could happen if and when people use these 2.0 tools, and especially when we do it without a lot of preconditions or we're very encouraging of participation, people start to think, well, wait a minute, they're going to use it to harass a coworker. They're going to use it to broadcast stuff they shouldn't broadcast. They're going to use it to waste time at work. And it's very easy to come up with a laundry list of all the possible bad things that could happen with Enterprise 2.0. So I spent some time in the book going through those, talking about why and how they don't really appear to be that bad in practice. And then making the case that as I've gone around and tried to collect horror stories, my collection is still almost empty, and we see astonishingly few examples of people misusing these tools and tons of examples of people using them in positive and appropriate ways. Then the second fear is that once the tools are actually in place, as we've been talking about for a while, people are actually going to find reasons not to participate. So the greater risk is not that people will use them, the greater threat is that people won't, and that's when we need to figure out what collection of strategies and techniques will get people comfortable and get them participating and contributing.
Now, in terms of adoption, Andy, you talk specifically in the book about the concept of the long haul, right? That's the phrase you use, and I thought maybe you could share just with the listeners a little bit about what you should be prepared for. Okay, I'm excited about E2.0. I convinced my management to set up an internal blogging platform or wiki site or whatever the case may be, and all of a sudden after a couple or 3 weeks, I don't see much happening. What do I need to do to sort of manage that, and how do I sort of come to grips with that realization that, boy, this is not going to be as magical or as simple as just slapping it out there and watching it take off?
First of all, if you have told your organization that it will be an overnight runaway success, you're in a bit of trouble already, because it rarely does work out that way. But when you find yourself in that situation, I would encourage a couple things. First of all, more on the technology front, have we really thought hard about how to make these things as frictionless as possible, how to make them just as easy to find and use as possible, and have we absorbed the lessons from the Facebooks and Twitters of the world that make these addictive, really easy and fun to use technologies? So first of all, have we made this tool set just as frictionless as possible? And then second of all, are we trying to find all the different ways to send signals that doing this is a good idea for your job, not a bad idea, will increase your human capital and your visibility in the organization as opposed to decreasing it? And then third, have we found both the informal and the formal leaders of the organization who are going to lead by example here and who are going to set up profiles and encourage people to connect with them? We're going to blog themselves. They're going to start tweeting themselves. And are we seeding these environments with the kind of content that will be compelling to people and will calm them down about whether or not this is something they themselves should be doing?
Right. Andy, thank you so much. I just want to make sure we get these last couple of announcements out before we're about at the top of the hour and the end of the show. First of all, thank you so much to our guest, Andy McAfee, author of Enterprise 2.0. Andy made a pitch for the book, and he was kidding, but I'll make a real pitch for the book. Absolutely.
Totally.
If you're in HR and you're interested in these tools and you've bought in, if you're listening to this show, chances are you've bought into this. You believe it's important. You believe it's relevant, and you're excited about it. Get the book. Give it to your CFO, your CEO, your VP of HR. Absolutely. I highly, highly recommend it. It's written to way that it doesn't require a real in-depth technological background to understand, but nor does it sort of condescend to folks who don't understand the technology. It's just right in that sweet spot of explaining the business issues, the technologies, and some really sound advice of how you can make this work. So absolutely my highest recommendation on the book.
Thank you.
Great, and Andy, thanks so much. You can find Andy's blog at andrewmcafee.org, and there's a blog link out there as well. And anything else, Andy, you want to mention? Any place else you can find? Is there a sequel to the book or an
update? I'm working on another book right now, but in the short term, my Twitter handle is amcafee, A-M-C-A-F, as in Frank, E-E. I'd love to engage with everyone.
Great. Andy, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're traveling, and I really appreciate you making the time for us tonight. And it was our great pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you so much. Shauna, great. Get better. Mark and Beth, thank you so much. Everyone else listening, tweeting, thank you so much. That's it for us from the HR Happy Hour. I'm going to say goodnight. And thanks, Shauna. If you want to open up all the lines for a little after show, please go ahead. And that's it. Good night from the HR Happy Hour. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Andy.
This episode of HR Happy Hour, sponsored by Acquire, a leading provider of workforce planning and analytics solutions and enthusiastic proponent of free stuff. Go to aquire.com/downloads for free software trials, free webinars, free podcasts, free case studies, and more. Did we mention it's all free? Acquire.com/downloads. Who doesn't like freebies?
Hey, Shauna, can you hit the stop sign and stop the song because it's not working for me?
I was going to say, why did you pick Ladies' Night?
Thank you.
You're so silly, Steve.
Oh, my God. Hey, Andy, if you're still there, thank you so much. Please don't feel obliged to hang out with us. This is just a little after-show chat.
Hello, everyone.
Shauna, good time tonight. It was fun.
It was fun. I'm sorry I really couldn't contribute.
Well, I had a ball. Who's out there with us still?
I'm here. This is Mark Birch.
Hey, Mark.
Who?
Hi.
Hey, Mark Bennett, you're still there, right?
Yep.
There's too many Marks
hey
on the show tonight.
There are
hey guys,
too many
I'm Brian Abramowitz.
Brian,
hey,
how are you, buddy?
How y'all doing?
Fantastic.
So my twins have just sat through their very first HR happy hour.
Your little babies, you mean?
Yeah, the little babies were sitting here intently watching the phone that they heard it all.
That's super cute.
I'm not sure if I should have subjected them to that.
Oh, it was fun.
Great show, though.
Thank you. I tell you, it was a great show tonight. Fantastic. Wait, you know, tons of great content. Could have kept going for
very
a while.
Very
you know,
yeah,
it
probably
and,
could have gone for another few hours. I mean, this is good stuff.
Yeah, and I just do need to make this announcement. We are on the after show. We are not live streaming on the internet, but what we say on the after show does make the recorded archive, so please be mindful of that. Thank you. But, yeah, it was a great show. It's a great book, and, I was being completely serious. I highly recommend the book, and you know, I know for lots of the people who are listening to the show, they sort of get it. They understand the technologies. They understand the approaches, and but, yeah, give it to your CEO or your VP of HR then if you have to, because it really lays it out in a way that's great to understand and great to help make your case, absolutely.
Hi, guys. This is Beth. Thank you so much for letting me pipe in today, Steve. Appreciate that.
Oh, Beth, thank you so much.
Great.
I appreciate it. It was great.
You were helping Steve out. That was awesome.
It's a great topic, and it's something that I think a lot of companies are wanting to do, not quite sure how to do it, dabbling with it. Some are having success, some are not having success. So it's very timely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I guess over time, right, there's enough of the high-profile case studies out there and more coming each year, right, that organizations will see and hear about that will
Yeah, we really need to do that, and we need to keep talking about it. We need to keep doing the metrics on it, on the success of it, so that it doesn't fizzle the way the wikis did and some of the other things that did not quite make it, because it's so close to crossing over to really finding its place in an organization just as a matter of course, but we're certainly not there yet.
Right, right. Yeah,
can you imagine if it was like the way email is in an organization, if E2O was the standard?
You're right. I know. I've just, you know, when you, and you know, the funny thing is too, like what'll happen as people are moving, right? People are moving from organization to organization, right? As like always have and will continue. But if you're like in an organization that's fairly, you know, progressive, a little enlightened, and then you happen to walk into one that isn't, you know, and it's like, oh my God, what happened? It's almost like they don't have electricity or heat, you know.
That does happen with companies who restrict even things like email. I mean, we still run into some companies who have large populations of their employee don't have email access, if you can imagine.
Wow, yeah. It's crazy, yeah.
So someday this will all just be the standard, and it'll be kind of funny to be even talking about it as an issue.
Right. But, yeah, no, it was good. I thought it was a really good show. I like to try to, you know, we're really trying, Shauna and I are trying hard to try to expand the show a little bit to, you know, get topics and guests who are outside of the normal folks that typically have been listening or appearing before. Not that we don't love our normal listeners and our normal guests.
We do like new people, though.
But a neat high-profile guest this week. That was terrific.
Yeah. I tell you what, it was great for him to come on. Shauna and I are working hard at it. We got Dave Olich a couple weeks ago, Andy McAfee this week. And Shauna, how's Dan Pink coming? We're going to get Dan Pink. We are going to get him.
I'm doing my best.
All right. We're getting him. So if anybody knows him, let me know, by the way.
Totally.
Great. So, Shauna, I'm going to let you go because you're not feeling so good. And anyone out, any last words for anyone in the after show before we sign off for the night?
Hey, Steve, it's Mike Krupa. Great show.
Hey, Mike, how are
Mike.
You, buddy?
Hi, Mike.
Thank you.
I'm
Hello.
Sorry, I can't go for you, Mike.
That's all right. I'm mobile now. So
I love
not,
it how Krupa.
I'm not even looking
I love
at
it Twitter. How I love it how Krupa makes the archive at the last minute, right as I'm about to end the show.
Yeah.
Well, I was in the car and trying to find the mute button while driving so I could unmute myself.
Awesome.
Be careful.
That was good stuff tonight. Well, just thanks so much, everyone. Beth, Mark Bennett,
thanks,
thank you
guys.
So much. Andy,
yep.
I think you're gone, but thank you so much. And Shauna, hang in there. Good luck on your trip tomorrow and the next day
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be following your adventures from the road, absolutely. And, we will see what's on next week, Shauna. Oh, we can't say. I didn't even get to say this, Shauna. Dang it, Shauna. We'll have to tweet this out. But I will say on the archive, we have a secret guest next week on the HR Happy
Hour.
You guys
have to guess who it is.
It's our first ever secret guest show next week on the HR Happy Hour.
Yeah.
We are not saying who it is.
No, but it's a good one.
Oh, it is. I think it's a great one. It's someone we've been chasing.
It's probably Mr. Scrubby.
No,
I love Scrubby.
Scrubby would be a good catch, but we've even had Ken Ruett on the show, so I'm not, you know,
we've gotten some really good people.
This guest is somebody we've been chasing for ages, and we finally got
totally.
Him, so I can't wait for next week. So, and then the week after that is an HR Florida show, because a bunch of us are going down to HR Florida, so we agreed to do a little HR Florida blogger kind of show. And then after that, who knows? We'll figure
Very
it out.
Very exciting.
So, thanks so much from the HR Happy Hour, everybody. Thanks to all the listeners, bloggers,
hey.
Tweeters, Mike, Mark, Brian, Beth, but everybody.
Hey,
thank you so much. Yeah,
thank Steve.
Thanks for that was a great catch getting Andy McAfee. Excellent
thank
job.
You. You know what? You just got to ask. That's what I'm learning. And then keep asking and be persistent. Thank you.
Yeah, that's key.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Thank
you.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.